Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Adam McNeil, PhD student in the Department of History at the University of Delaware. Today, I'm chatting with Dr. Alicia Gaines about her amazing book published by our friends at the University of North Carolina Press in 2017, entitled Black Fur Day, White Fantasies of Race and Empathy. And Dr. Gaines is an associate professor of English at the Florida State University. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gaines. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, and thank you so much for having me, Adam.
Very good, very good. Well, before we begin, getting into the particular book, Black Fur Day, can you talk to us about what sparked your interest in such a topic?
Yes. So I had just finished my prelim exams at Duke University, working on my PhD, and I was trying to figure out what my dissertation project was going to be. And I saw a commercial for an FX cable show, a reality TV show called Black White. And I was fascinated. So the premise of the show is that two families, one black, one white, kind of switch their races via Hollywood style makeup and prosthetics. And they're supposed to kind of understand each other through walking in each other's skin. And I was so blown away by first of all, the makeup is very creepy, but B, how do we get to this moment? What is the genealogy that has cable executives say, oh, this would be a great idea in 2006. Let's have these families switch their races and then live together in a reality, kind of like real world style house. I wanted to know who had done this kind of racial project before the Wurgles and the Sparks did. And that led me back to John Howard Griffin's Black Like Me in 1961. And then with more research, Ray Spriggle and Grace Housel.
Yeah. And I think it's so, so interesting. And I wrote this down last night when I was putting together some notes. It's so wild that, the International Day of Telling, typically white folks and I do blackface, aka Halloween, right, was like yesterday. And then also, I guess it would have been the end of the previous week or the beginning of this week with the whole Megyn Kelly situation, where apparently, I guess, a 40 plus year old woman apparently thought that blackface was a cool thing and an okay thing in her childhood, right? Yeah, okay, interesting. And so I think we could see a bit of a genealogical connection to the story that we have here, to even literally pertinent events that are going on in the culture right now. The providence is amazing. And this is another reason why we are happy to have Dr. Alicia Gaines, a Tallahassee person right now. And I'm a FAMU guy. So it was just amazing. I knew I had to have you. With that as well, so can you talk to us about kind of how you lay out your argument with this book, and also kind of you spoke a bit about a couple of the folks and also the titles. Could you break that down for us a little bit more about the particular stories that you're speaking about in Black Like Me, or Black for a Day rather?
Sure. So Black for a Day, really I'm thinking about a genealogy of what I call empathetic racial impersonation. So of course it's an offshoot of both passing and blackface minstrelsy, but really these are mostly white liberals who think that changing their skin is going to give them some kind of insight into the black experience. So famously, John Howard Griffin did this project. He took kind of anti-vitiligo medication, the same disease that Michael Jackson had, mm-hmm, that depigmented his skin. He took the corrective to that, so actually it made it hyperpigmented. And then he would tan himself in sun lamps and things like that, and then walk around to try to experience life as a black man all throughout the South. Before him, a journalist from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette named Ray Spriggle, he spent what he called four, harrowing weeks passing in reverse. And he was unable to find something to darken his skin. He was trying to use topical creams and everything. He never got around to medications. but he just shaved his head, wore a shabby hat, and just Jim Crowed himself. So literally the line of segregation became how he delineated himself and marked himself as a Black man traveling throughout the South, meeting various people, and then writing a series of front page articles about what it means to be Black in 1948, even though he'd only been Black for at the most 30 days. Grace Housel, who was kind of a mentee of John Howard Griffin, she dedicated herself to the project more than the two men who'd done it before her. She wanted to experience Blackness as a woman. And so she took also medication. She went down to the tropics and kind of gave herself a beautiful suntan, and then went to Harlem. In Harlem, and this was in the late 60s, so the Black Power movement is going on, and she finds that they're just, the Black folks in Harlem were not authentically Black enough for her. She was Blacker than they were.
Wow.
And so she decides to go where, you know, the font of authentic Blackness really is, the South. and goes to Mississippi. And finds that, you know, she wants this Black folk experience. And she just comes up with these just very bizarre kind of assumptions of what it means to be a Black woman. And also what it means to be an ally in this moment. Like, we don't need white folks to dress up as Black people to start a conversation about race. And people made that very clear to her in the late 60s, but she basically ignored them, took it upon herself to do this project because she wanted some kind of transformative experience. Then chapter four is on Black White, the TV show I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Again, it's this, you know, strange attempt in 2006, which is kind of astounding that we're going to have this quote, social experiment is going to change race relations in the United States. But really all it was two families who didn't get along, doing kind of mockeries of each other, mm-hmm. In Black and white face. And then, you know, it just kind of spins into nothing. And then of course the epilogue with Rachel Dolezal, who I call the last soul sister.
I laughed so hard when you characterized her as the last soul sister. I literally was dying in the library. It was like ridiculous.
Well, I appreciate the laugh. I wanted someone to laugh at that because Grace Housel's book is called Soul Sister. And so it's a nod to her, but also it's everyone else in this project. They do it temporarily. Rachel Dolezal, and she's changed her name now to Nkechi, mm-hmm. I believe, Diallo. So she's the one who just doggedly refuses to return to whiteness. She is adamant that she is Black, and that no matter the fact that she created this social media firestorm around her identity, she will hold on to that Blackness for whatever it's worth and for as long as she can. And I also didn't talk about the introduction to the book, which is, it sets up the project because when I was in ninth grade in my Northeast Ohio high school, I was in the Broadway musical Finian's Rainbow, but our high school's version of that. And there's a Blackface character in that musical. And I was one of the people actually helping to make him Black off stage. It's a wow kind of thing, because what was anyone thinking? And again, it's supposedly an empathetic character. He's a racist man who a leprechaun, it's very convoluted, but a leprechaun over a leprechaun's pot of gold, a woman makes a wish that he would understand what it's like to be Black, and that maybe that would somehow erase his racism. So he magically becomes Black. And I helped him magically become Black by, you know, smearing paint all over his face off stage. And then he, you know, experiences life as a Black man, goes around and sings in this barbershop quartet. And all of a sudden, he's not racist anymore. And that was from, that was the post-war, the original musical was from the 40s. So it's definitely a post-war kind of project that that blackface or walking in someone else's skin, or what I call empathetic racial impersonation, would be this remedy to America's racial ills.
And the way that you use empathy is just so, it's just so apt, and I think it has really it can be transferred to so many other areas, I think, too, because when I think about how these are not white people with white hoods on their head looking like cone heads, right? These are the white liberals that Jordan Peele, you know, was talking about in Get Out, or his funny Key and Peele skit where he's being President Obama and going down the line, the handshake line, right? You know, those are the kind of situations that I think of, or obviously the very, very funny Dave Chappelle skits from the early 2000s, which, oh my gosh, what a great time to be alive. But yeah, so I think that's the interesting part, right? You're talking about white liberals in this moment, right? You're talking about people who, I want to feel the Black experience. Now, I've heard that for a long time. I'm only 26, but I've heard that many different times. Or the common refrain, I listened to NWA and I am Blacker than you. Or something like, you know, to that effect. Including, you know, singular examples of Blackness, or, you know, artistic, you know, things of the Black experience. And it's like, nah, bro, like, you don't understand. But the good thing, but the interesting thing that you do is you interrogate the people that, you know, did literally try to understand by effectively deforming themselves. And so what were the experiences like of many of these folks when they were traversing racial lines in the dangerous Jim Crow times? And obviously Jim Crow is very, very dangerous. Definitely not satirizing that, but satirizing them trying to include themselves in that, right? What were their experiences like?
So it differs with each kind of impersonator, or actor, or whatever you want to say.
Right. How do you characterize them?
I kind of think of them as impersonators.
Okay.
Or even performers, because they really are often performing their own version and their own interpretation of what it is like is to be Black. None of them ever seek out Black folks to get kind of to understand what's like. They kind of have their own ideas. So the experiences differ. Ray Spriggle, he's in the 40s. He actually is traveling with John Wesley Dobbs, who's civil rights leader out of Atlanta. And so he's traveling with him, and he doesn't really experience anything, even though he's Jim Crowed himself throughout the Deep South. He actually laments the fact that he doesn't experience any kind of racial terror. He said, gosh, this would be a much better story if something had happened to me, if I failed to serve someone. But at the same time, he performs what I call good niggerhood. Because he does not ever push any buttons. He doesn't try to ruffle any feathers. He said he takes his hat off in front of white people and just yes sirs, yes ma'am all the time. He did try to go into a segregated waiting room at one point to see if anything would happen, and nothing happened. But that was the only time that he kind of pushed any boundaries. And so I really believe that. Because of the chaperoning he had throughout these spaces throughout the South, he was kind of sheltered from maybe what could have happened if he had been traveling alone. John Howard Griffin had a very different experience. Once again, it's a different time period, though. We're almost 10 years later when he starts his project, and he is by himself. He doesn't really want many people to know what he's doing. And once the articles start coming out in Sepia magazine, that's mm-hmm. when he starts getting some blowback. He is hanged in effigy in his hometown of Mansfield, Texas, where he literally has to take his family and go to Mexico and hide for a while because things just got a little too hot. White folks did not appreciate the sort of conclusions he was making about Blackness, even though this was happening in a Black periodical. Then Black Like Me comes out in 1961, and then a very, very bad movie version of that comes out in 1964. And he articulates about getting the hate stare and that he can't get any work. So he actually experiences some of the consequences of being Black while in the South. The kind of conclusions he makes about his temporary time as a Black person and what Black folks go through on a day-to-day basis when you don't have the refuge of whiteness to return to, that's the real problem with these projects. There's always whiteness just waiting when you get a little bit too sick of being Black, which is exactly what happens to Grace Housel. So Grace, you know, I told you she goes to Harlem. Those Black folks are just not Black enough for her. She's Blacker than them. She said they're trying to be like whitey. Goes down to Mississippi, starts doing day work as many Black women did in the late 60s in Mississippi. So she is doing domestic work, and she sets up in the book that she's so terrified that a Black man is going to rape her. She repeats it over and over again, especially when she was in Harlem. Well, of course, the twist in the book then, and you know, it's almost a little too neat to be maybe factual. I'll say that. I have my skepticism. So the twist in the book is, you know, she's doing domestic work in this white man's home. He comes home unexpectedly and tries to rape her. It is in that moment, and she escapes from him, runs out of the house, and basically says, "Well, I'm done. Like, I'm done being a Black woman. That was a lot." And she transitions back into whiteness and back into her white womanhood, because it was always, you know, there waiting for her. And the Sparks and the Wurgles, the two families in Black White, their experiences are kind of almost comical, because the white guy Bruno, who kind of is moving through various spaces in Los Angeles as a Black man, he refuses to see racism. He just literally can't see it. He said, "I wish something would happen. Things are happening, like women are clutching their purses and things like that. But they're the kind of microaggressions that he can't see. He wants someone to jump into his face and call him a nigger, and he says it a bunch of times. And then he's like, that's the racism that he understands. Like, if the KKK were to come and on the, you know, the whatever lawn." That they've rented for this family to stay in. If they were to erect a cross and burn it, that's the racism he could see. He does not see when people are clutching their purses or moving over crossing the street so they don't have to walk directly next to them, or jumping off the sidewalk into the street so they're not touching them. He can't see any of that. He just thinks that's just a regular social behavior. He doesn't see when they're followed into the store, or followed around the store when they're in the mall, or the fact that when he goes to a car dealership, and the person immediately says, "So what did we do to get your business?" And it's a little, you know, for those of us who have lived Blackness for a long time, you immediately pick up on, that's a question you would not ask that other person over there. But he said, "Oh, well, he was just so prompt and so eager to talk to us." No, he's surveilling you and he wants to know why you're here. And he wants to know if you can afford the cars that you're looking at. But he gets none of that. It goes completely over his head, even though there's a black family trying to point these things out as they're happening. He refuses. The only time he sees racism is when he feels some hostility towards from other black people. That's when he says, "Oh yeah, I feel racism here because I'm in a black neighborhood and I don't feel all that comfortable." So those are the kinds of experiences, right, that these impersonators, if you will, are having.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like, you know, diet racism is, you know, the main dish that they are devouring here. And you know, it's funny because to me, when I think about, you know, a lot of the stories that you talk about, and then, you know, the Black Like Me film that came out, I saw some of the pictures in the book, and I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, they didn't good, even good change. God didn't even change his
like
eye color.
You didn't even try.
They didn't even
like
try.
I was gonna say, you didn't even like that's the thing. It's like, that's how you know they were not like, they were serious about making the film, but they were not serious about like, all right, okay, if we want to put to the side blackface is just like outright wrong. All
right.
We put that to the side. We said that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we look at it about the film, right? Come on, man. Come on. This is how you know y'all ain't right. This is how y'all know y'all ain't right. But then also, this also brings me to bring it to a more contemporary moment when Zoe Saldana played Nina Simone, and the whole world tried to tell her like, no. Not only is it, because there have been, okay, we can say that Malcolm X and Denzel Washington, skin tone wise, are not adjacent. They're just not.
Right.
But when you look, the only thing that he changed was the hair. And really, that's about it.
Yeah.
But you look at, you know, Zoe Saldana, what did she do? A prosthetic nose?
Oh, she did so many things. I mean, she darkened her skin. Zoe had a prosthetic nose. I don't know what was up with that hair. She did so much that it became grotesque. It became cartoonish. It was not just if you have to do this many topical changes to your kind of body landscape to make yourself approximate sort of Nina Simone, then let's have some conversations. And also her doggedness in keeping that role when you know that you are just inappropriate for that role, especially when Nina Simone's body of work was so deeply connected to what she looked like, her brown skin and her thick lips and her nose. That was important to her, her aesthetic and her politics. So for Zoe Saldana to take that role and just let them do all the things that they did, it was disrespectful, to say the least.
Yeah, and so like I was trying to draw parallels to Black Like Me and, you know, to these different stories, and you know, you had mentioned before about these being performances. I was trying to think about like, how do you, like, I was thinking about as I was reading, like, as like a secondary piece, you know, how do you articulate what these people are doing, but then also what are the audiences that are taking in this, do you call it art, you know, are they, you know, how are the audiences, you know, taking, specifically, I would guess white audiences, but, you know, also how black audiences take to these particular performances once they are put out to the world. Because obviously they're portraying these roles, and then there's no point in portraying it if you're not going to then, you know, write about it and interpret it out to the world. So how did that take?
Right. Good question. So Spriggle, the guy who did it in the 40s, he was the journalist. He really wanted a second Pulitzer Prize. He thought that this would be a good way to get to do that. So audiences, his newspaper articles did okay. They did well, but they did not garner him the Pulitzer Prize nomination that he wanted, because it's a bit, you know, it's a stunt. It's not deep investigative journalism. And he wrote a subsequent follow-up book to the articles, and it did like miserable. It was just it sold not very well at all. John Howard Griffin, totally different story. So Black Like Me is sort of the ur-text for these things. It's the one that people know the most whenever I say what my project was or my research. They're like, oh, like John Howard Griffin, that guy. Yeah. So that, and that's why it became, you know, it went from a memoir to the screen. It was a bestseller. It remains on high school and middle school reading lists across the country. So particularly it hit a cultural nerve in the late 50s, early 60s. And it definitely it was for white folks to read. What's striking is just today, I saw some kind of meme about, you know, Black men's health this month. And on the reading list of all this stuff about Black masculinity was John Howard Griffin's Black Like Me. This is
Get
today.
The hell out of here. You're, yeah. No.
Yeah. So on this list of people like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Kiese Layman is Griffin, which was,
oh my gosh. I wonder how they would feel about being on that kind of list. Like,
right. Ugh. So I was trying to figure out like the source, you know, of mm-hmm. who created this list about Black masculinity and put John Howard Griffin on it, but I couldn't figure out what the, who the person was or the organization was that was doing this, but it was something circulating on social media, all day this morning. And so, I mean, he's still, for whatever reason, still resonates with people. I always do short polls in my classes, who's ever heard or read this book. And still I'm getting hands that go up. Oh yeah, I read that in high school. I read that in middle school.
Now, that's just so inappropriate.
It's so deeply inappropriate. How about you read something written by a Black person? How about we just retire? But there's something which is kind of my curiosity about it. There's something compelling that about these projects that even, you know, to come again to them in 2006, there's something deeply compelling about, oh, can I experience the other, but kind of flirt with it in a casually dangerous way. Because I know that A, I can get a book out of it or a TV show, and B, I don't have to be this permanently. It's always temporary. Even when Rachel Dolezal says that she's never going back, she still has the option to go back. And that's what makes it completely different from everyone else who identifies as Black. As far as Grace Housel's reception, very different because it was a Black Power movement, like I said. People were literally writing to Ebony saying, she had a big spread to promote the book in Ebony, of all places.
I was like, wow.
Yeah, 6-page spread. And people are saying, writing letters to the editor, like, what is this? Like, we don't need you. Thank you. We've got it from here. please, no one asked you to do this. Even in the book, she talks about someone who critiques her saying, like, why are you here in Harlem? You liberals love to do this. Just come and study us. We're not your study subjects. And she dismisses all of those critiques and insists on doing it anyway. And, you know, she, Grace Housel doesn't just become Black. When she's done with Blackness, she becomes Native. When she's done with that and writes that book, she tries to pass as an undocumented Mexican migrant worker, which is fascinating because how do you fake not being a citizen? And she's crossing.
In this moment. Oh my God.
Absolutely. Birth,
citizenship. Absolutely. Good God Almighty.
Yeah. Wow. So she's really, really trying to find herself through this kind of exploitation of otherness. And she does it multiple times. But is lost kind of to the annals of history because no one really remembers her for doing it.
And you know, this is the interesting part, and I didn't know if I was going to ask you this, but your last couple of minutes made me think about it. So as you're writing this book, what is the time frame in which you're writing it specifically? Because I only ask that because when I think about the fact that the Rachel Dolezal bit is your epilogue, As far as like your writing process, how did you go, like what was the time frame at which you were writing this? Because I think that is like a fascinating thing that I'm thinking about right now.
Yeah, I probably did most of the writing between 2012 to 2016. It came out in 17. So right around there.
Okay. And like I said, I asked that because I was thinking, you know, when, as you're talking out, I was thinking like, man, and I mentioned this to you offline, like, what the hell would this book be like if you began it, shall you say, in 2014? And then, you know, now you are, you know, you complete the book in 18 and it comes out next year. Like, I really wonder because, you know, do you watch Insecure or have you seen any of the episodes of, okay. So, you know, oh, okay. So I wanted to make sure. So, Issa's, coworker, it's not really just her coworker, just her whole office, right? They are these white nonprofit working on behalf of quote unquote urban black children or black and brown kids. And, you know, kind of like this, how they are portrayed is very much in line with what a lot of what you're talking about here, about this racial empathy. And though they're not putting on blackface, some of how they act is as if, you know, they're it's really shenanigans, portrayed as being, you know, down. Yeah, man. Dude, like I remember, like when crunk music and everything was really hot in Atlanta and throughout the country in the early to mid 2000s, I would be out with friends and you know, we'd have these white folks, you know, be like, yeah, can you teach me how to Dougie, man? And I'm like, make it the hell about my face, bro. Like, no, hell no, man. Because you know they're trying to, it's, you know, it's jingoism, man, and so. You know, hey, if I want to dance, I'm a dude to dance because I feel like it, not because you are the puppeteer putting your hand up in my body and making me move. Nah, man, we ain't doing that, right? So, you know, your book brought back so many memories, and many of them being in Tallahassee, right? And so. Whew, yeah, there's a whole bit. Even I'm a big country music fan, and so I was at a concert I forget the museum that's out in the sticks, but and so, you know, we had a country artist, Luke Bryan, come, and I remember we were out, you know, doing our legally appropriate thing, I had this woman from Florida State, a white woman, be like, oh my gosh, you would fit in so great at Florida State. I was like,
what? What does that mean?
Like, I'm not gonna lie, I was drunk, but then I was like, oh, whoa, I sobered up real quick. I was like, nah, man,
right.
Like, I don't know, like, don't get it twisted. Like, I don't know who you think you're, like, yeah. So it was just one of those, like, really, you know, really, and to a certain degree, a lot of this racism is sobering, right? It will sober you up in a state of, you know, hysteria, and not in a situation that you would choose. And so that's why I think this book is so powerful and so important, because for so many people, I think that it's the blackface, God knows, I hope isn't reminiscent of real life, but what it does do, it provides, more of a contemporary, modern genealogy for this, that obviously connects back to Jim Crow minstrelsy in the 1820s and 1830s, but, you know, it's very reminiscent of our time today. And why we should not be surprised that somebody like Megyn Kelly would say that, what she said in 2018.
Right. And I really do think that when you, the fact that this is done by like well-intentioned people, supposedly, really, really helps get at the kind of the lie of white liberals, who are the ones who are supposed to be, quote, allies and are often doing, a lot of the damage to folks of color, because they're not listening, because they're assuming, because they want to be down, like you said. And so to do that, they're, you know, taking all bits of types of cultural appropriation, wanting us to be their friends to make them look cool. Or they can have some kind of purchase in different spaces. That's kind of the insidiousness of it. I'm so tired of allies. I don't need any more allies. I need co-conspirators at this point, because we are at a point where just being empathetic is not enough. That is clear from the kind of socio-political moment that we're in right now. And so we need white folks who are willing to not just be empathetic, but be empathetic plus something else. And I think the something else is to take some risks, and to not just wear a safety pin and a pussy hat and say that their work is done.
And so that really brings up another element of your book, and that's really it's a social justice book as well, to a certain degree, because you're articulating that these are not Bull Connor's cousins that are doing this, right? These are the supposed people that are adversarial to, they are the people that during that famous 1966 interview with Stokely Carmichael, when he was the head of SNCC with Mike Wallace, and he asked, well, what about the white people for the cause, right? What about, how do you feel about them? And Stokely Carmichael says, you know, if they're for the project of Black freedom, then they should be able to go on the ride that Black people take them on, right? So if you really are about helping, right, not allying, but, you know, actually being co-conspirators in the cause, then, you know, you're going to have to take a backseat to what Black people want. And, you know, white, you know, and that's why I think, you know, one of the parts I loved about your book was that I just loved how it was written. Like, it was so amazing. And so there was a particular part there are a couple of bits in the quote unquote Last Soul Sister chapter. One of them, a lot of them being on page 169, and one of them being, you know, similar to Halsell, Dolezal is a failed white ally using over-determined Black experiences to overshadow structural inequality, end quote. And then another bit, a little bit further down, what Dolezal says, in yet another interview, she claims, and I quote, sometimes how we feel is more powerful than how we're born, end quote. And then you say, Dolezal's self-definition of Blackness is the epitome of white privilege. And I was like, oh, yeah, you doggone right. You doggone right.
Yeah, she goes on to say at some point, I think it was after the book came out, she said, well, I have the right to self-identify. I was like, do you, girl? Do you have the right to self-identify? Well, that is very white of you. Like, it's very, very white. Because that is not the case for many people. It was just so dripping in privilege. And she can't see the irony of that at all, of her saying that. Just completely blind, willfully blind to it.
And I hope that this is not an inappropriate comparison, but when I thought about, you know, in the moment that Rachel Dolezal's happening, you know, you also have Caitlyn Jenner publicly proclaiming that she's a trans woman. And this is happening, I believe, in the same summer.
It was.
So, you know,
2015.
And so... Right, in 2015. So, you know, and then you transfer that to, you know, you hear, and I remember seeing all the memes saying that, and you speak about this in the book, which goes to the importance of social media in books now. The memes that showed, you know, well, if you're okay with one, then why not the other? If you're okay with Caitlyn Jenner being Caitlyn Jenner and not Bruce anymore, then, you know, what about, you know, Miss Transracial over here, right? You know, and so the conflation, and then you bring it to now when you have people at the same time as the Brett Kavanaugh situation happening with the Supreme Court and the rape allegations. Then you also have someone like Bill Cosby going to jail as well. And then you had people conflating the two, right? And so, you know, they're really, you know, obviously it's not racial empathy, of course, but, you know, these these moments of conflation happening in the culture and in the world at the same time. And so I think that, you know, it's a very odd thing. They're very odd because they're not happening isolated from things that are to some antagonistic towards it.
Right. So Rachel Dolezal definitely is not happening in isolation. And that's what I think gave her 15 minutes of fame. I think people trying to understand Caitlyn Jenner coming out, kind of like it collapsed upon the Rachel story, even though those are two separate and distinct things. It got kind of jumbled up. And like you said, the memes that were, if you can accept one, you can't use, not being able to have really substantive conversations around the fact that Caitlyn as trans and Rachel as a white woman with a curly wig on are two very different things. And we can't conflate one with the other. And then also to sort of very strangely want to, I don't know what it is, protect the legacy of Bill Cosby by pseudo defending Brett Kavanaugh. It's like, what? We can, these are two different, Bill Cosby is not Cliff Huxtable. And we can separate those things and hold Bill Cosby accountable. I know that he was everyone's favorite dad, but he did unspeakable things to countless women. And no matter how many pudding pops he sold, he needs to be held accountable for that. Brett Kavanaugh should not be on the Supreme Court. But that doesn't mean that Bill Cosby shouldn't be in jail.
Mm-hmm. And you know, going back to the Cliff Huxtable versus Bill Cosby bit, you know, I just remember thinking, like, once, you know, the women were, you know, the dozens of women, ironically, another comedian got another black comedian to go underneath, in this case with Hannibal Buress. But thinking about how, when, you know, believing people, right, you know, and believing their stories, and also thinking about how Heathcliff Huxtable was a OBGYN doctor, right? And so, like, that's the part that to me was the most, like, not the most, of course, but that was one of the more grotesque bits of it,
yeah,
too.
It's creepy, right?
Of how you perform, you're performing a task, right? You're performing a particular job, a career bit on a television show that brings you into, like, you know, the mainstream, shall we say, where even some white folks are really, you know, adopting this black family, a particularly molded black family, of course. And then you see all these things happening, and then, you know, a lot of these different stories are happening within the time frame of the Cosby Show, which runs for quite a long time, especially even when you add on the spinoff after the actual Cosby Show ends. And then you also have the different worlds too. So all in all, like, when you talk about these performances and these different bits, yeah, you know, some people may say, oh, we're complex beings. Being complex and being a rapist ain't the same thing, bro.
Absolutely,
like, let's just stop.
Absolutely
that.
Not.
Like, let's just cut that real quick. And so, oh man, this went interesting. I wouldn't say it went dark, but it went somewhere.
Yeah.
Damn it, Cosby. But you know, I've really, really, oh my gosh, it's 44 minutes gone. You know, your book, Dr. Gaines, is really one that I think a lot of people should really read. And I really think that for one, after this interview, oh, and before I get any further, shout out to Dr. Mark Anthony Neal, because I found out about your book through your interview on Left of Black his previous season. And so I was like, Florida State? Local? She went to Duke? Oh my gosh, we got to get her on for this book.
Yeah, definitely shout out to Mark Anthony Neal. He's been a great mentor throughout my whole career.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, shout out him, and shout out, you know, all the folks down there at Florida State and at the Florida Agricultural and Mechanical University, October 3rd, 1887. What? And so, you know, that it just really rolled off the tongue. It's a wild that way. And so before we let you go, Dr. Gans, can you tell us anything else that you're working on that we can anticipate to bring you back on for another amazing conversation?
Yeah. So the next project I'm working on, tentatively called Playing a Slave, but actually I'm going to be... So the Rachel Dolezal thing happened, the epilogue happened because the reader report, the readers had my book and it was happening while they were reading it. So you have to have a Rachel Dolezal epilogue, but it was not the original epilogue I had to the book. The original one was about my time when I went to a place called Connor Prairie Interactive History Park in Fishers, Indiana. And for 90 minutes, you got to play a fugitive slave.
No.
Yes. Oh, God. I know. For $20. I did it twice. I paid $40 altogether. So you kind of, they mimic the Underground Railroad. You get sold on sort of a makeshift auction block. They call you things like breeders and they call the men bucks. And it's very intense, this kind of immersive public history. And I'm interested again in empathy in this moment, and what these kind of educational programs are supposed to be teaching us. So I will be doing projects like Connor Prairie, dusting off that original epilogue around the country and a couple of international sites as well, to think about why I talked about sort of these kind of empathetic racial impersonators in the first book. The second book is going to think about sort of what happens when we do it in kind of a living history kind of a way. What are we supposed to learn? What do we learn? Especially when these are geared to middle school and high schoolers, often these really very complicated narratives around slavery. Why do we have to learn that by immersing ourselves in tragedy and trauma? And so I'm really thinking about how we learn what we learn around race, racism, and empathy in this next project.
Good grief. Oh my gosh. When you say like playing a buck, I can only imagine like a little 12-year-old being like, "Mommy, I'm playing a buck." And I'm like, yeah. "Yo, what are you like what?"
Yeah, it's wild because the kind of reactions to this go from like nervous laughter, outright laughter, to kids crying. A guy got in a kid's face and was yelling at him and he just broke down and started crying. So it's pretty intense.
It does sound like that. And I've heard of many different stories as a public historian who's been in these, random places in America, and the knowledge that people bring and the places that they go to for this, it's like, it's like an exhibition. It's really one of those situations where I'm just thinking, like, for one, how the hell did you why do you think that, for one? And then two, really thinking about how the performance, right, playing a slave, like, and you hear these stories of teachers. There's this Montessori school, I guess last year, the year before, that was playing on that kind of bit too. Like, let's, and there's only like one or two black kids in the class, so you obviously know who's going to be playing the slave in this case. So it's just like, and then it even goes to like, you're talking about racial empathy and how black kids, when the story of slavery in class, especially when there are, there's limited black air to breathe in these spaces, so only a couple are allowed in. And so what happened, like, that the, another meme, life is very memeable, and I love, thank God for memes, where you have that situation where like you see the whole row of white kids turned around looking at you with a smile on their face, like, it's time to talk about the slavery, let's do it. And it's like, yo, like, for one, why this on me? Y'all were the ones, y'all family members are the ones that did it. I ain't the one. Y'all should
and
be
also,
the one.
And also, I wasn't a slave, right? Like,
right.
That's
right.
So
like, I was not.
That's so strange about those moments. I had a moment like that in seventh grade where my history teacher literally turned off Roots after we put it on for 15 minutes. And he only did that because it was the last day of Black History Month. And I finally said, are you going to acknowledge Black History Month. I was the only Black kid in the class. And he said, oh yeah, I was waiting for you to mention, to bring it up. I wanted you to bring it up. What? I'm 12 or 13. And then he puts on Roots, lets it play for about 15 minutes, stops it. And he said, you know what? On the other hand, how about we let Alicia talk about slavery? And the entire class turned around and stared at me. And just, what? Well, I'm here to learn too. I wasn't a slave. Like, what? The sort of knowledge that some white folks assume that we have is and then we are then supposed to impart to them for their benefit and at their demand is quite astounding.
I agree.
Astounding. We'll leave it at that.
There are many different ways to describe it. And so astounding. We'll keep it. There might be people that are 16 and 17 listening. We don't want to corrupt their ears any more than we have with this blackface shindig that these folks keep doing. Man, oh god. But you know what? You know, this part here is another part that you spoke about in your epilogue as well, and how even, I guess between the Rachel Dolezal situation and the murders in Charleston, there's this time frame where Black folks, specifically online, right? You saw this a bit obviously through news, but specifically through Twitter and online forums, that Black folks had a space in that particular time frame between the Dolezal situation and Dylan and the Charleston situation, of Black folks just taking time out just to laugh, mm-hmm. right? And I think that was another part that I enjoyed that I didn't get to speak about as much, but that was a part that I did value, because it brought me back to those memes and to the different gifts and ask Rachel different song lyrics, like from Earth, Wind and Fire, or from Lil Boost, like Nuck If You What, like what's the lyric that comes right after that, right? I come to club shaking my what, throwing his what and busting his what, right? Like these different bits that I haven't really used. I've never used Nuck If You Buck in this kind of way, right? Come to the club, shaking my dress, throwing his balls and busting his ass, right? You and I have blocks. Like, we can actually do this. Like, but the thing is, right, this is this is a part of us, right? It doesn't need mm-hmm. to be performed, because it's, like, internal to us because of our experiences. But also, Black folks having, like Eddie Murphy did in the 80s with this as well, as you characterize, Black folks have the chance to just laugh at the ridiculousness of it, right? Mm-hmm. And we are the curators of that intellectual space of laughter. And that's important. And I think that's very important too. And I really appreciated you for bringing that to the fore as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was a rough summer, and it's been a series of rough summers in the Black Lives Matter movement. And sometimes there's some catharsis in just laughing. I was going to say we were laughing at her, laughing at.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Sort of Rachel's brazen Blackness. It was nice to have that kind of, kind of cookout moment and just mm-hmm. have some catharsis.
And we definitely need that. And thank God it's November, because we have Shirley Caesar and her 2 years long. I got beans, greens, tomatoes, and we got, it's November 1st, so we can dust that off and bring that, clip back. We can bring back the hashtag Black Thanksgiving.
Black Thanksgiving,
hashtag. And oh God, those are just, those are what I see as, like, when people try to down social media and down Twitter, I'm like, there's bad things everywhere. And so this is a good part about Twitter and, Black mm-hmm. Twitter and the Black spaces that we carve out in this white world, or this white, it's partially a white world, of course, but that's a whole nother book. But but nevertheless, you know, Dr. Gaines, I've appreciated all 50 now 5 minutes exactly.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it's gone by really quick. Oh my gosh! But hey, that's what happens when you're amongst friends and you're having fun.
It's true.
And so once again, folks, we have had the honor of having Associate Professor of English at Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida, Dr. Alicia Gaines, talking to her about her amazing book published by our friends at UNC Press entitled Black for a Day, White Fantasies of Race and Empathy. And good God Almighty, this has been an amazing conversation. And we cannot wait for you to come back again.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. It's been really fun.
Very well. And once again, folks, my name is Adam McNeil, a doctoral student at the University of Delaware in the Department of History. And it's been a pleasure to have Dr. Gaines on the show. And until next time, folks, this is Adam McNeil once again, over and out.